afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for coming to the American Security Project. I'm Steve Chaney. I'm the Chief Executive Officer. And let me lay out some ground rules right up front, and then I'll talk a little bit about ASP and why we're here today. I'll introduce our speakers. We'll start with General Kearney and then Admiral Fallon. We'll follow up with a Q&A session. During the Q&A, we don't have a roving mic, so when I pick on somebody to ask a question, if you could please stand up, state your name and affiliation, and speak loudly and shortly. We'll have a pretty good proceeding, I think, here today. This forum is on the record, and we are taping it, and we'll have it up on our website this afternoon. Our hashtag is over here if you're so interested. American Security Project was founded in 2006 by Senators Hagel, Kerry, Rudman, and Hart, and the intent was to take topical issues and discuss them in a nonpartisan way with a national security bent to them, and I'm sure a couple of those names are pretty familiar to you given what's happened in the last couple of weeks. We're rather excited to have the Senator Kerry nominated for SecState and Senator Hagel for SecDef. Apprehensive because I'm sure both will depart our board, but I think it just is indicative of the quality of the board that we've got at American Security Project. We are a small, lean organization, but we take these topics and expose them to the public and hopefully educate you, the Hill, the Pentagon, the general public on what's important to our national security in relation to these subjects. And that's why we're here today. We're going to talk about Iran and the costs and benefits of a military options associated with Iran. Now, a report was put out in September of this past year by the Iran Project, and I'm sure some of you might be familiar. It was called Weighing Benefits of Costs and Benefits of Military Action Against Iran. Then they subsequently came out with another report in December on international sanctions on Iran. Now, we can talk about either one, although I'm not the sanctions experts, nor are the two gentlemen to my right. Our expertise is on the military side of the house, but all three of us signed up to that initial report on military options in Iran. Now, these are obviously very interesting times, and this subject has died down over the last couple of months, but some interesting developments yesterday and today. IAEA inspectors left yesterday and arrived in Tehran today, and there's been an announcement that there will be talks now on the 28th and 29th of January. So these are two pretty, in my opinion, significant accomplishments that heretofore had not occurred in the last 6 months. We all know our election's over, Russia's election's over, Israel's election coming up next week, and of course they have an election in Iran in June. So a lot of this is getting pushed back, and now we're finally getting some progress made on Iran. But today, our focus wants to be cost and consequences of military action against Iran. You've read the biographies, I'm sure, and you know these two gentlemen to my right, but let me point out some things that perhaps are not obvious. General Kearney is a combat veteran of Grenada, Panama, Bosnia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Pretty amazing, and he's had a fabulous career. Admiral Fallon is a combat veteran of Vietnam, Bosnia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. And we got nice representation here. We got the Army on one side, Navy, and I'm here to take care of the Marines. Admiral Fallon retired as a four-star admiral. He spent 8 years as a four-star admiral, culminating as combatant commander for first the Pacific Command and later as Central Command. And Admiral, 41 years of service to our country, to which we thank you. And General Kearney, 35 years, we thank you as well. An attack on Iran won't be like anything that Israel did to either Syria or Iraq. It won't be like Osiris, nor will it be like Al-Kibar in 2007. It's not going to be a pinprick type operation. And if you look at the report, a lot of this is discussed in some detail. I'm sure everybody here is familiar. Iran's got multiple processing facilities and enrichment facilities, at least six, not the least of which is Fordow, which is buried some 300 feet down. Also, they have a considerable air defense capability. So when you talk about a military option, this is going to be something much, much, much bigger. Obviously, all of us prefer a political solution to this problem. But there is a military option. And when you look at the signatories to our paper, which include, by the way, Senator Hagel, and I can tell you Senator Kerry feels the same way, we want to use the military option as the last option, but we want to discuss what the ramifications would be of a military option in association with Iran, and they're significant. And it's important that you understand it and that we understand it, we recognize that it's there. I think Senator Hagel's made it clear, he certainly did with his interview with Senator Schumer the other day. If we need a military option and if we have to do it, we will do it. We will not allow Iran to possess a nuclear weapon, and I think that's clear. So with that, I think I've laid the groundwork, and General Kearney, I'll turn it over to you.
Hey, thanks, Steve. First, thanks for the opportunity to be here. It's important that we had this discussion in a public forum. I think it's probably not been as public as it ought to be, and probably has not been as forthcoming in the minds of what's been going on in a political campaign, and clearly is competing with Lance Armstrong and other important priorities globally for time to discuss what's important in life. I think the Iran Project's purpose was exactly to have forums like this to get folks out on public media with a great document that kind of lays out the objectives, the costs, and the benefits of potential military action and the attendant risks. As a soldier who served a number of tours in combat with a son who remains serving in combat, it's of great interest to me personally, as well as for the soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines I have served who will be doing this over time. The policy of the United States is pretty clear, though often argued, as people try to refine the policy and put a red line in there or a trigger for when are we going to take some action, what are we going to do beyond what we're doing with the sanctions regime, with diplomatic talks, in what would trigger military action. Again, this administration is reasonably clear that they do not want the Iranian government and the Iranian people to have a nuclear weapon. There clearly is a timeline associated with that. We argue about the fidelity of that timeline. How long will it take to complete enrichment to 90%? How long will it take to weaponize that capability? Do they have the right missile technology and quality of missiles to deliver a product to make this a weaponized effort? In the other piece of this on the sliding scale is that Israel and the United States have two different capabilities, and that one nation who is very, very close to the problem and sees it as an existential threat has a capability that has a timeline that begins to shrink as you look at enrichment being complete to certain levels and then move to a hardened storage facility, that their ability to interdict, damage, or degrade is far less than that of the United States. And as a result, the United States has a much longer window, has far greater capability, and probably can do a more sustained effort to get at that. But it comes to the crux of international relationships, which is all about trust. And so those were the big issues that I kind of peeled out of this report, and one of the reasons that I'm into it. When you look at how do we need to define this as a military professional, the real question that I would always ask political leadership is, what are your objectives? What is it you would like me to accomplish as a military player in this? And then what are the policy objectives that we should be striving for? Is it in fact to destroy capabilities, and do we have the capability to do that right now? I think there's great debate on how much damage we can do it for now, how much time we would have if the Iranians would be able to move materials around and what the effects are. And so we have a window of how long we think we can degrade that process. Is there a hidden agenda in there where it is really an objective to degrade the military capability of the state of Iran so that they're less of a regional hegemon, so that they're played better with their neighbors? Will it adjust the balance of power in the region? Is that something that we want to accomplish, or is that just collateral damage in attacking the nuclear targets that are there? Ultimately, people talk about changing the behavior of the Iranian state, which means changing the behavior of the Iranian regime. You can't kill knowledge, and therefore the knowledge will exist post-strike, post-military action, and unless the nation state and its leaders decide they don't want to pursue a military or a weaponization and a nuclear option, that potential still exists. So you have the risk out there that military power may not achieve whatever those three objectives are, whether it's just the degrade and delay so we can continue to have dialogue. But what is clear is that without military power as a lever and without it as a credible threat, that we probably can't move a regime that is completely against the West, that it's part of their culture to be anti-West, to take pressure from the West and actually yield and make decisions is very, very difficult for them. So you have to have a lever, you have to have a threat, you have to have something that causes pressure. What can we hope to achieve? What are the benefits? I mean, clearly the benefits are destruction of some of the capability. Delay for this paper articulates 2 to 4 years, but certainly there's arguments on the higher end of that that it could last longer. I'm not quite sure we know how fast and how determined the Iranian regime would be to rebuild, or if they should they choose to do so. We take a look at a unilateral Israeli response and say it could be up to 2 years that we could delay the program, given their capability and what they could do. We certainly would see that as a deterrent to others who would have a problem. It certainly aligns our actions with our words, which is good for U.S. credibility with our neighbors and our partners and our allies. And frankly, it tells folks out there that if you want to be in the nuclear business, you need to follow the regimes that are laid out by the United States, the United Nations, I'm sorry, and the IAEA to be able to do things. Military operations are always fraught with risk. You never know quite what will happen when you open Pandora's box and take action. Clearly, the biggest threat is an economic threat. As we threaten the oil routes for 20% of the world's oil as they move through the straits, of course, that has an adverse effect on the Iranian economy as well, and so it's not in their self-interest to keep those closed for a very long time. Merely threatening action will do that. They will watch the price of oil move up, but some of those economic threats are also benefits in that they will bring, hopefully, some unlikely players at this point in time to the table diplomatically to apply pressure as well. So the efforts are not just military. The efforts are military, economic, all to drive people to come to the bargaining table and talk. Of course, we stand to lose credibility if we have to strike preemptively, and it's not abundantly clear that the Iranians have a nuclear capability. We have we certainly have baggage from our Iraqi decisions as we move forward, and it would erode our position in the world if we can't prove after the fact that what we have stated is unequivocally clear as we move forward. We risk breaking down the sanctions regime that has existed, the alliance we've kind of put together to put pressure on them as we move forward. So when you look at this, it's a good public debate. We've got objectives that we have articulated. We have some that may be behind the scenes, or we could be on a slippery slope away from just delaying and degrading their nuclear facilities. But all that fraught with risk as we move forward. And so we think that military power is always a last resort, but it has to be on the table. And I think that's what's articulated clearly in this document. I'll go ahead and finish my comments with that.
General, thank you. Admiral Fallon, I know you've had extensive experience in the area, starting with Central Command, and I know you have strong opinions about Iran and military options, so we welcome your remarks.
Well, thanks, Steve. A pleasure to be back and be able to join Frank, my old neighbor from CENTCOM, a man who has a lot of hands-on experience in the region, and we share something else in common, too. We have mountain hideouts out in Montana. It's a long way from Washington. Politics are a little different out there, and very, quite different than this climate in a lot of ways. I would put in a short pitch for ASP. I'm really pleased to be a member of the board here. It's a rare organization in this city that really strives, as a matter of foremost principle, to try to be nonpartisan, to take all opinions and to work with them to try to reach consensus on key issues that we face. And there's a long list of them here. You see some of the propaganda and things around on the bulkheads and in the handouts. It's a really good cause, and there unfortunately not enough folks that I see in the city that are committed to the kind of cooperative mental activities that this group advocates, so pleased to be a piece of that. I guess to get into this subject a little bit, it might be worthwhile to at least I'll give you my view of some background here and why this is a continuing problem, this being the relationship between the U.S. and Iran, and certainly by extension the nuclear issues that are related. So we have 30-some years of tension, to put it mildly, friction, outright hostility, certainly a trust deficit with a capital D. We've had a very, very tough relationship with this this government of Iran after the revolution in 79. For better or for worse, I've been tied up in this region ever since then. I was out there early 1980, and since then I've been back and forth many times. So I've got a chance to know some of the players, certainly to have what I think is a pretty good understanding of what goes on in the background. It's complex, but the fundamentals are really boiled down to a few key facts. We have virtually no relationship between the two governments. That's on the official side. Very interestingly, there's a tremendous amount of personal relationship between individuals, Iranian and American, who not only go back and forth pretty regularly, but a lot of family ties that are pretty deeply rooted in both countries. So we have several levels of activity that go on. And of course, there are advocates at every level for actions here, there, and everywhere. Frank alluded to the reality of kind of one of the pillars of the foundation, if you would, of the regime in Tehran is a very, very strident anti-Americanism. And there's a long history in it, and I'm sure some are very, very familiar with it. I'm not going to recite the thing chapter and verse, except to say that certainly in the spoken and written words of the leadership in Tehran, the U.S. is at fault for numerous things that extend way beyond the revolution of 79, and the basic issue is the U.S. is a great big meddler and basically have come into this region, the Gulf area, and they shouldn't be playing the role. And what's unspoken there is that the Iranian view of things is that they're the locals, they've been around for thousands of years, and they deserve to play a major role in the region, and that's clearly an objective. Many things have happened over the years to raise the levels of antagonism, and so we're left with where we are. I can't do too much about the past, none of us can, but it seems to me that what we have to do is deal with the present and look to the future. And the future would be bleak indeed if in fact we end up with nuclear weapons proliferating in this region. If you were to tie that with some of the stated objectives of the government in Tehran, it's no surprise that it gets people in this country, and particularly in Israel, pretty uptight when we listen to some of the rhetoric that emanates from Tehran. So with that as background, we have the other activity that from our view in the U.S., and I'll align myself with not only this administration, but the previous administration and several before that, in a bit of puzzlement over observed Iranian activities in the nuclear area compared to their rhetoric. And so if you would believe even the most recent comments in the last couple of days, there's no intention whatsoever, says the leadership of Tehran, to pursue nuclear weapons. In fact, we have a fatwa, and the supreme ruler has issued this, and of course, you know, he would never go back on his word, and so not us. But the some of the facts around belie those statements. The secret activities that have been discovered on several occasions by UN inspectors after the fact, where the Iranians not even sheepishly, grudgingly admitted, okay, well, you caught us, so we'll tell you something about this on a couple of occasions. We have a very, very aggressive program to enrich uranium that by, it seems to me, most reasonable views far exceeds any peaceful requirement that anybody could conjure up. So this has created an atmosphere of distrust, of concern, and the potential, if you add the rhetoric that's come out of Tehran to obliterate Israel and several other similar phrases, and to to get people to be very, very concerned. And so what do people do when they get concerned? They look for solutions, and a handy one, at least in terms of talk, has been, well, let's go whack these guys. We've got a strong military here, and why don't we just put it to use and take care of this problem militarily? Were it so simple. Frank has already mentioned the reality that, and Steve as well, that there are some precedents for dealing with budding nuclear weapons programs, both in Iraq and in Syria. But this is a little different because it is not a pinpoint target. There's not one place, there's not one strike that can take care of this problem. And what we have endeavored to do in this document that put out a couple of months ago was to invite people to, in keeping with the principles of ASP, although it didn't come from ASP, to sit back for a minute and just contemplate some of the facts here and some of the realities that would be involved if one were to decide to, quote, use the military option or pursue that military option. And probably from a long practitioner of the that particular brand of national power, the biggest comment that I would make is that it is unlikely to be easily done, when I say easily, in a very short period of time with a minimum amount of force. It's probably going to be a very detailed undertaking, and the Iranians are working overtime, in my opinion, to make sure that that's the case. So I don't know what their real intentions are, if anybody has any insight there, please speak up and educate us all. We can only judge by behaviors, it seems. And behaviors have been unsettling. Very interesting of late, hasn't it, though? It's gotten kind of quiet. If you were to look at the history of the last 30 or so years of U.S.-Iranian engagement or lack thereof, it seems to me you see these episodic periods where things really kind of go dormant for a while. And you're left to wonder what's going on, what's happening in the background. People might have an opinion, happy to hear those today. But activities that have been ongoing, the sanctions have been brought up already. My opinion, there's not a great history of success in sanctions in many places. However, this is something that's been going on for a long time. And they hurt, there's no doubt about it. To what extent they hurt, to what extent recipients of these sanctions can overcome or try to mitigate, they aren't going to recover, but try to mitigate varies. There's lots of history out there for this. There's little doubt in my mind that they're hurting. I advocated some time ago that if we really wanted to get serious in trying to get the attention of the regime, that the pocketbook was probably a really good place to start. And, when I was out in CENTCOM, watched it with interest the activities in Dubai, which seemed to be the central bank for most Iranian financial things. So that's a little different now. There is a pretty good bite in the wallet, and I think that's having some effect. But there are all these other factors that come to play, and we could probably spend an hour, and I don't want to do that. I want to cut myself off here in about a minute, but were it also simple. So we have people that are very close to this area, closer than we are, physically and otherwise, like the Russians, who, it's been speculated, have high interest here, could be helpful, have not been particularly so of late. It's in their backyard. Historically, they've paid a lot of attention to this place, and I suspect they still are. But they have other motivations, and of course, our relationship hasn't been great with them. China, India, emerging economic powers, that have huge demand for raw materials, particularly energy. And so Iranians are eager to push their products because frankly, that's their economic lifeline to continue success in that country. So there's a pretty strong pull economically to keep them going. The region, people in the region, the other states, the vast majority are Sunni based, highly distrustful of the Shia predominant regime there. And of course, the chorus of voices that I heard when I was out there in the region hasn't changed a whole lot today. You got to do something about this problem in Tehran. I used to ask regularly, what would you like me to do? Don't know. You got to do something. Don't attack them, but figure something out. Take that under advisement. But it just illustrates the complexity and the challenges. So there's a lot of anxiety. It's ongoing. And the idea that the reason that this, the motivation for this document was the seemingly easy to slide off some guns will just take care of this thing with a military option is not nearly as easily done as someone think. May be necessary at some time, but probably not the best idea if we can figure out another way to prevent the spread and the proliferation of nuclear weapons in this regime. So I think I'll cut it off there. Steve, you want to open it up for comments?
And Admiral, if I could piggyback on that and take my prerogative as moderator and ask a quick question of both of the when you talk military options, and of course you were intimate on military options, I'm sure, in the planning of such in Central Command and General Kearney the same in Special Operations Command, the range is huge and the cost can be, I don't think so minimal, but can be literally billions, if not tens of billions of dollars. Can you address at all what you think might be the scope or the cost associated with the military option?
I'll take a crack at it to start. First of all, it all depends on what the objective is. There are some stated objectives around here and in Jerusalem that we need to just get rid of the nuclear program. My opinion is that's not likely to occur unless someone is willing to dedicate land forces to go overrun and occupy those places. So if people think that's an option, I think we're talking big dollars and long time frames and many people. And frankly, I haven't heard many reasonable voices that are advocates for that. But if you want to make sure the problem goes away, that's probably the only way that I would have high confidence it's going to happen. Short of that, there are many other options from tiny to very large that would involve attacking, trying to destroy as much of that capability over there as possible. A couple of challenges. By the way, it's not just limited to Iran that we have these difficulties. North Korea is another case where most everything is buried and you can't really see it. You can estimate. Our intelligence agencies are pretty good at that. But at the end of the day, in this business, you never really know everything you'd like to know. The stuff's underground. So we pretty well know generally where it is. and could probably do a pretty good job of making life pretty difficult for those that are around there. What would that mean? In practical terms, you could set the program back for some period of time. We took a crack at it in here and said probably if the U.S. were to put a full-fledged strike campaign in there, that would probably take several weeks. You could put this program back for several years. We would speculate that if the Israelis did it, given the scope of their capabilities and some other challenging factors, they can probably also set it back for some period of time. That's probably not as great because the challenges of sustaining the kind of campaign that we require. The bottom line is it's not going to be a one-time shot. It's not going to be like 81 or even 2007, just because the scope of the thing is pretty large.
Right? I think the other variable in there is how does it start? If it's a preemptive, deliberate effort where we've made a decision that we're going to go and do things, then I think you can go ahead and deliver the military capability of the United States in a way that we would want in a strike campaign for some period of time that escalated in different levels of achievement of damage, which would result in delays and things like that. But if it starts in an unexpected way through some incident that we then begin to have to make decisions along the way to do things, it would be far more protracted and probably less efficient as we tried to get at the effectiveness we want to achieve in an air naval campaign in there. The cost, as Admiral Fallon had said, would be significant in any regard. As you look at the amount of fuel, platforms, weapon systems, weapons that are going to go in there. These aren't cheap munitions to get the job done with. Should we have to use land power, which is not the policy of the United States right now, that probably would be required to guarantee a change in regime behavior, the cost would be astronomical. The real cost comes in economic power. As we begin to look at the cost of fuel globally and the pressure that people are going to put on us, is how much is that going to cost in the world economy? How much is that going to cost in people's pocketbooks? And what is the pressure going to be able to do both on the U.S. Side of this and on the Iranian side? And how does it move us to some sort of solution? And then how long do we go? The plans that we have are very detailed to be able to do the things we need to do should you get to decide how and when you deliver the effects you want to deliver.
There's some very practical realities that come into play here. To get to some of these places requires access. If you could make an assumption that the Iranians would roll over and say, do what you want, I doubt that's very likely. And so I would expect that our commanders today would have that same view, and so they would probably insist on or ask for permission to take care of the defenses that would likely interfere. Once you start outlining what's really required to do that, you end up with a pretty good campaign. And then there's always the question of, again, stated Iranian preferences. We're going to shut the strait. So could they do that? Yeah, they might be able to do it for a short period of time, but I doubt that we'd allow that to happen for very long. And so if that's going to be a play, then you have to factor that, what's going to be required to take care of that problem and make it go away. So I think you can get the idea that the idea of simplicity here, not likely. It's going to be pretty complex and pretty detailed.
You know, the title of the book was Costs and Benefits, and ASP, we want to change that a little bit, say cost and consequences, and I think we're detailing some of that here today. There are immense consequences, and the reason we're bringing this topic up is it's very complicated, it's not easy, it's not a knee-jerk reaction, it takes a lot of time and forethought, and we want to expose that. I want to just read one quick line here and ask one more question, and then I'll turn it over to the audience. There's a line in here in our report that talks about the increased likelihood of Iran becoming a nuclear state, and we say in the report, quote, in fact, we believe that a U.S. attack on Iran would increase Iran's motivation to build a bomb, and then we lay out some reasons behind that, and part of it is that they might think we're after regime change, and they're just going to dig in and make it worse. I'd be interested in both your opinions on that particular comment in the report.
You know, one of the things we discussed in multiple forums was Iranian reaction, how they would perceive this. I think a base assumption is they believe we are after regime change. So I think anyone who looks at our stated objectives from their point of view, there's only one: regime change, move us out. It's the only way to achieve our objectives, and they believe that we've wanted to do that for some time. So I think you have to expect that as a military planner, one of their reactions could be that they are going to go ahead and sprint to be able to develop the capability, or at least articulate the rhetoric that says they're going to do that and demonstrate the actions to the degree that they can that say that, so that they gain more leverage and more power in the post-strike arena. So that was part of the discussions that I was involved in, and I think that's key in their strategy.
We don't really know what their plan is or how well thought out the plan might be. clearly, to be ambiguous is the play. They're doing pretty well with that, and you know, whether they would try to reach a certain level where, if you, the report's actually pretty good primer here on the fuel cycle. If anybody's interested, you can do 10 minutes and come away with a pretty good idea of kind of what's entailed here, but the physics of it. You know, how close they could go, and then what's left to do, and how much to actually get enough material to weaponize this, and then there's the business of actually taking the material and making it a functional weapon, and then there's the other issue of the delivery mechanism. So these pieces have to come together. There's little doubt they've been working on pieces of these. at what point they try to pull them together, if they were to opt to do that, remains to be seen. So again, ambiguity is in play here, and lots of doubts.
Not always all bad strategic ambiguity, but we'll have to see how it plays out. Again, remember my rules on questions. I'll pick on you if you could stand up and state your name and affiliation and speak loudly and short. Yes, sir.
Trina Bartosik from NIAC, National Iranian American Council. Thank you so much for this, and thank you for the reports that you guys have put out, which I thought were quite decisive in the impact that it had on the debate in the city. The question I had is, there seems to be an increasing appreciation that there is a more or less logical solution to this, one in which clearly the Iranians have to implement the additional protocol, have full transparency, but they would keep enrichment below 3.5%, but there would be such a strong buffer that would make it essentially impossible for them to use enrichment and have a path towards a nuclear bomb. Yet on Capitol Hill and in other places, there's a tremendous amount of resistance towards any solution that is not based on zero enrichment. From your perspective, what would the geopolitical, military consequences, if at all, be if such a solution were to be found, in which the Iranians do have enrichment below 3.5%, but they do implement the additional protocol and other inspections and verification systems that essentially makes it more or less impossible for them to weaponize? Would it be the disaster that some people are saying, or is it manageable, tolerable? What would the consequences be?
Go ahead, sir.
The issue will come back to trust. There is little to none today, and to implement something like that would require trust that I think could only be supported by a pretty substantial verification program. So you use the term impossible, Trudy, a couple of times, and I'd back away from that. Be careful of those kind of absolutes. At the end of the day, there's going to have to be, in my opinion, some kind of negotiated compromise. And exactly what that entails, probably come pretty close to an outline that might be a foundation to go forward. What would probably have to change is for this side would be some significantly enhanced confidence that we could get access to see what's actually going on the ground, or have some parties that we could have a high degree of trust and confidence in that could actually verify these things. Without some kind of a verification scheme, I don't think we're going to get very far. But to get back to the fundamentals, there's going to have to be some negotiated settlement or steps towards a settlement at some point in time. So how that's going to, exactly what the first footfalls are going to be to actually get that moving is anybody's guess. Tamping down the rhetoric is probably a good place to start. Some confidence in activity levels might be something else. The thousands of centrifuges spinning, you kind of raise your eyebrows at talk that doesn't match that kind of activity. But I mean, who knows what the pieces are. I'm not the diplomat. We've had a lot of them that we've talked to, that were a party to this document, that seem to think that there ought to be ways ahead. I agree, just as a non-diplomat, that there ought to be ways to do this.
I think there's a large difference between bargaining positions and where you get to, and I think we're always at great risk when we say we can't get somewhere. We've had great success at negotiating nuclear weapons with other players. We understand the protocols required for verification and those kind of things. But I think Admiral Fallon hit it right from the beginning. It's about trust. It's about building relationships. So nothing is going to be easy, and nothing is going to be an end state early in the process, and we'll move towards something there with the same amount of, with some on-the-side collateral rhetoric that continues to go on that affects things throughout this process. Hopefully the core of people who negotiate this and the other players who are involved will keep it at a level where you can have a conversation and understand that it is a discussion and a negotiation that both sides have to give.
Yes, sir.
I'm Howard Moreland, private citizen. As I understand, the only nuclear weapons in the Middle East are U.S. nuclear weapons and Turkey and Israel's nuclear weapons. Now, if Iran were to make a statement, which they may have already kind of made in so many words, that, okay, we do have a clandestine nuclear weapon program, which we're hiding from the inspectors, but we're willing to accept any restraints that Israel is willing to accept. If Israel joins the Non-Proliferation Treaty, loses its nuclear arsenal, and opens its weapons, its facilities to inspections, we will follow, we'll do everything Israel's willing to do, because what we want is either a nuclear weapon-free Middle East, or we want our own nuclear deterrent. That sort of states the situation as it exists, but Iran has not been explicit about this. What do you think about that?
I don't think Israel is willing to give up anything in regards to its nuclear capability, and never will. Now, whether Iran's going to use that as a bargaining, you know, factor against them, it's just not going to happen. And I think it's a dead issue from the get-go. But I'm interested in your perspective.
My approach to this would be first things first. First issue in my mind is U.S. and Iran. We have enough baggage, enough problems, enough difficulty, just one-on-one. I think once you start pulling in other states and other activities, you just make this very, very complicated. So the focal point of regime, at least my read of the history, the focal point of the regime angst, to put it mildly, their complaint, if you would, is with us, not Israel. It's the U.S. We're the problem. We've been the problem all along. We've meddled with Iranian politics. We've, by their view, helped to unseat a couple of governments. And so, should we be shocked that the mullahs think that we can do it again? Might be inclined that way. There's plenty of things to deal with just with the two of us. And, I think my suggestion would be, if I were given the responsibility to go wrestle this pig, would be let's try to make it as simple as possible and just work on U.S.-Iranian issues to start with. And there are plenty of them, and they have they extend well beyond.
On that side, all the way in the back. Yes, sir, with the glasses. There you go.
Thank you. Matt Duss with the Center for American Progress. Admiral Fallon, you mentioned talking to regional leaders who wanted the U.S. to handle the problem, don't attack, but handle the problem. If we look back at the WikiLeaks, I mean, this is one of the main takeaways that people took from the WikiLeaks documents, was leaders in the region, Arab leaders of Arab states, pressing the United States to deal with the Iranian nuclear problem. I'm curious what both of you think the last 2 years of these upheavals and these very significant transitions we're seeing in the region in various countries in various ways, what impact this makes on the calculations and the possible costs and consequences of U.S. military action against Iran?
I don't think the last 2 years changes the U.S. position vis-a-vis Iran and those Sunni nations that are very, very much feel a threat from a growing power in Iranian capability, military-wise, and the potential to have a nuclear weapon. I think they still probably want the U.S. as a partner to help and provide them at least a military shield should things fall apart there. I don't think we're done with what's going on in upheaval in Sunni monarchies or autocracies, and I think that those will be 10 to 20 year issues as we roll through different types of governments and things. And I think it's incumbent on the United States to ensure they understand where they are with those governments, what their positions are, any impacts of what military action or potential military action against Iran might might too. I think it plays out probably dirtier in the press and in the street than it does amongst the leaders of nations who are trying to solve the hard problems over there to keep oil flowing and commerce moving globally.
I would say that probably good to keep in mind one fundamental reality, again, in my view, in the region, that is that the concern is really the other nations, all Sunni, very concerned because Iran is, first of all, Persian in leadership, not Arab, and I think just as importantly, it is a revolutionary regime that is actively fostering that kind of activity. So that not only raises eyebrows, it causes high anxiety. And probably the best example of that was the Saudi reaction to things in Bahrain. This activity is ongoing. Conspiracy theories abound, I'm sure, as the leaders in the region sit around and talk about this. They're probably speculating to what extent Iranian behavior may be behind some of these Arab movements, although frankly I think that this is a double-edged sword for the Iranians. My sense is that they've got a lot to be concerned about because their principal ally and colleague in arms, Syria, right now is pretty much ripped apart. Pretty big question mark over what happens next in Syria. Of course, the implications for a lot of the surrogates, and the folks in Tehran are very very strong advocates of having other people do their dirty work, so they've got lots of folks out there that have been doing that in Lebanon and Gaza and so forth. So to what extent that changes, yeah, there's some a lot of upheaval, a lot of concern, but I think it cuts both ways. So certainly the regimes that were concerned about Iran for the reasons I stated are still very concerned. But now that this democratization or sense of we want to have some say in our futures continues to bubble and boil in the region, I think given the Iranian regime and their behavior, they've got a lot to be concerned about too. So it cuts both ways.
Ms. Smith.
Diane Barnes, Global Security Newswire. As you know, Iran has cited its national security interests in making its case against opening its Parchin base to international scrutiny. To what extent do you believe inspections of portions of that site by the IAEA pose a legitimate threat to its military or other interests?
Well, I personally don't think it poses any threat to their security interests. I mean, and they've been spending a long time cleaning up whatever was going on there, if something was happening there. And so I'm not quite sure we would be allowed in there without it being rather clinical, the protocols being rather tight. I find it hard to believe there's any risk for them as they control the environment that we would be invited into.
Yes, sir.
Eric Tamerlani, Arms Control Association. I have just a short question. As we know, new talks are set to begin soon. And I'm just wondering, what's, in your opinion, the window of opportunity for those talks to succeed before Iran's enrichment activities pretty much, if you would, force a military response?
I would caution against the, it's got to be this or got to be that. I was in Israel some months ago and had that proposition put to me. It's either we have to bomb them because they're going to bomb us. I didn't think that was a great place to have your head. Who knows? I guess the bottom line. But I would say that there are some other dynamics at play here that might be fruitful. The Iranians were well aware of the fact that we had an election, and there was a lot of who knows what they really thought about what was going on here and what people really think. That's one of the challenges of this whole thing. When you work through these filters of people who are have strongly held views and preconceived notions of both sides about the other folks, you tend to latch on to lots of things that you hear with little way to actually be aware of them. So, but at any rate, I think the folks in Tehran it was pretty obvious not much is going to happen until after our election. How closely they were watching the election in Israel, I suspect it's more than passing interest, but again, I'll go back to the focuses here. It's Washington, Tehran, what do we do? So if the next set of meetings at the end of the month are going to be more of the same, there's not going to be a whole lot of appetite in this capital, I think, to continue to rope-a-dope this thing. Certainly some kind of expectation that something's going to be different. So that difference could be a lot of things, not just talk, but activity on the ground. So I think we're all kind of eager to see what, if anything, is going to be different. Meanwhile, with these other factors that are in play, sanctions are out there. They're grinding away. It's got to be painful to these folks. The time issue, the Syrian issue, probably not particularly going too well from a regime standpoint. And as this country develops its newfound energy sources, or newly the technologies allow us to do things, and that potential may exist in other places in the world, that factor, the economic factor, the pressure that China and or India might bring or not bring in this thing, there are a lot of things in the air that could make
I think that one of the things I always keep in mind is there is a science timeline to all this, and to the degree that we have collection capability, whether systems or whether human or whether other governments or whether IAEA is still in there, those will help us determine when the windows begin to close, where diplomacy has to ratchet up or other things have to ratchet up before we get to military options, which are kind of always on the table. But as you begin to work all those elements of power together, I mean, there is a timeline. You can't change the science, and you can't change the time it's going to take to enrich, to develop, and to make it a useful weaponized product should they decide to do so. So, I mean, I'm always worried when we talk about, well, we're moving to military. We don't just move there. We move there informed by everything else that's going on the ground. North Korea might make us worrisome as we lost some visibility there.
So the only thing I would add to that is the status quo is not steady state. Things are always changing. So as these centrifuges continue to spin, as Frank indicated, it pressurizes the situation. Other factors at work too, but nothing is frozen in time. So all of this is part of the discussion.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
I'm Olson from International Center.
Could you speak up real loud because we have trouble hearing you?
I'm Olson from International Center for Religion and Diplomacy. As you explained about the cost benefits or the consequences of military action against Iran, I was wondering if there's any consideration for the cost benefits or the consequences of this military action on Iranian civilians or the Iranian citizens, given the fact that a lot of these facilities are pretty much close to civilian areas. I'm wondering if that could be a kind of deterrence, or does it actually have any effect in making a decision about military action in Iran? Thank you.
Of course, these are all factored into considerations. And cynical regimes make it a point to work hard to raise the stakes, if you would, by putting people at risk in these kind of situations. So it all gets back to the fact that when you consider using military action, you've got to be aware of the consequences. And the dilemma is always at what point do the perceived challenges, threats to one side outweigh the potential benefits? So it's certainly in the minds of those that have to make these decisions.
Yes, ma'am, right here.
Yeah.
Sarah Gordon, Georgetown University. This question kind of goes beyond military intervention, but Kenneth Waltz last year posed the theory that if Iran does develop deployable nuclear capabilities, it wouldn't be as devastating or destabilizing as people think, that it actually might have a balancing effect. Do you think we're past that argument, or do you think there is validity there, or do you think it's helpful in current discussions about what to do?
I got to tell you that I think it would continue to be destabilized. I don't see it as a balancing factor in the region at all, from my point of view. So I don't see how Iran having a nuclear weapon that is in a weaponized format could really help in this region.
I mean, I think the unstated implication there is just let them have it and it'll all work out in the wash. I would point to one of my other challenges a couple of years ago, and that's in Pakistan, Indian-Pak tensions. I didn't see a whole lot of good coming out of the proliferation of nuclear weapons in South Asia, but to be exact.
And you can draw that line further, look at North Korea and the tension that's created with their nuclear weapon in Asia. I certainly concur with both of you on that angle. Yes, sir.
Yeah, Bill Jones, Executive Intelligence Review. When it's a question of trust is really the basic issue at hand here. We're going to have these discussions on the nuclear weapons, the P5 plus one. Probably won't result in any dramatic changes, but there are other issues in which we could be discussing with Iran, kind of a track two, on issues that are acceptable up to us. Obviously, we don't want Iran as a hegemon in the area, but they do have certain security concerns which we could cooperate with them on. It happened during the early years of the Afghan War, in which they were actually very helpful in dealing with a problem that was our problem as well as their problem. There are issues like the drugs coming into Iran from Afghanistan. Wouldn't it be feasible to have some kind of another discussion, maybe it's set up to be kind of a good cop, bad cop sort of situation, but in which the Iranians, in which you could discuss with the Iranians some of the overriding security problems that they feel they have, in which the United States could be useful, perhaps creating the trust that isn't probably going to come directly out of the nuclear issue, but would have reverberations in those discussions as well. Is that an option?
There are any number of things, it would seem to me, that we could find common interests to form the basis of discussion. If you look just at the security issue, we actually tried this a couple of years back in 2007. We thought we had a pretty hot issue at the time, Iraq, and so there was actually an attempt made, you may recall, in Baghdad to sit down and have a discussion between Iranian and U.S. representatives that they got basically nowhere and caused us from my side, or our side, if you would, at the time to question what the real dedication to doing something significant from the other side was. I drew the conclusion not very high, just from the folks that were sent to represent the talks and their very, very limited ability to engage in any kind of meaningful conversation. So the short answer is yes, but like anything else in this business, it's not going to be easy, and it's not going to start out with sudden, like, let me hug you, I now trust you, we're going to put everything aside and start out. That's not going to happen. So it's going to be a tough negotiation. Any number of things could be a foundation to get going. They have legitimate interests in the region, we know that. In fact, they could be helpful, and there are a host of other things that we can do cooperatively that might be useful. It's going to have to be a motivation. So The motivator on this side is, I think, pretty clearly the potential threat of weaponizing their nuclear program. And for their side, we can speculate, you know, what the pressure point really is, you know, how much the sanctions really hurt. Are there other economic issues? Do they perceive a shift in the balance of power in the region? Blah, blah, blah. I don't know. But my sense is that we'll get down to serious talks when both sides recognize that there's a really significant motivation to actually have a real discussion.
And I think the variables in time, place, and context can provide that opportunity. You've got to be open to them. But I think, as Admiral Fallon says, we're probably going to go to a whole lot more pressurized situation before those opportunities present themselves, and an opportunity to get in there where you can have dialogue and do something to move forward. I mean, my belief is this will get worse before it gets better. That dialogue is not going to be the initial solution. It's going to be pressure from a lot of different aspects as we pressurize the economic piece, the military piece, the rhetoric goes up, and then I think we'll come to the conclusion that this is way too dangerous to go any further.
I can take one more, and I see a hand there back in the right.
My name is Hayes Brown with Think Progress. Earlier during the talks, General Kearney, you implied that a preemptive strike would be preferable in terms of being able to control the situation more, as opposed to having to make a split-second decision, followed by more split-second decisions, et cetera, when having a military option all around. With all the talk about red lines, et cetera, would there be any sign that such a decision has been made, short of aircraft crossing over the Iranian border? And supposing Israel does decide our red line has been crossed, we're giving a go order, do you think that would make U.S. involvement more or less likely, given that in the report it says Israel would set back, an Israeli attack would set back the program a much shorter time than a U.S.-Israeli joint attack?
Clearly, being able to control the circumstances is always in your best interest from a military point of view, and so making a decision will be very, very difficult without all the knowledge we might want to have to do this where we initiate. But that is always preferable to reacting unless you have the time to build up power. It will be interesting as we adjust the amount of military presence we have in the Middle East over the next few years. I mean, we have a lot of capability there based on our presence in Afghanistan and previously our presence in Iraq. And as a result of that, what's there and what's ready in a position to do something will determine whether or not there is a signature to prepare. And so it's really hard to say at this point in time, will people know or will the first thing be aircraft over some borderline? But always preferable to control your decisions and the conditions you operate under. And frankly, it really all depends on what is in place in theater when someone might decide or when some action might provoke a response or some misperception would occur where we are now in some sort of a scuffle that escalates.
Two comments. One, keep in mind that there is a huge difference in military capability here between Iran and the U.S. It's very significant. So one would hope that the Iranian understanding of that is not diffused by some myopic wish that it isn't that way, or that they begin to believe that every time they shoot a missile in the air, that this becomes a big threat to the U.S. Second point is, I'm not a big fan of red lines, because put a red line out there, and somebody crosses it, you now have an option of having to do something or having to put yourself in a position where you feel you must do something, and it becomes kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Much better, as the Iranians have demonstrated, their masterful ability to play the ambiguity card. You know, from our standpoint, let there be no doubt, we don't want nuclear weapons. If you weaponize, you really put yourself in a position that don't believe we're going to tolerate it. Don't make a mistake about our capability or intentions if you decide to pursue the weaponization thing. And okay, if we have that understanding, now there are 1,000 reasons why we ought to be able to figure out a way to start walking the dog back in a different direction, which is what we'd all like to do, it seems to me.
Admiral, that's a great summary and a great wrap up to this session. And ASP is an educational institution, and when you mention the size of the American military and those that think we can potentially do just about anything, it's never that easy. And I hope that we've educated you here today to understand that there's a lot more to the military option than some would recognize, and it's not easy. We don't advocate one way or the other than to say, look at our national security and consider all the consequences, as I indicated earlier. So I appreciate everybody coming in. I hope you'll hit our website, theamericansecurityproject.org. There's the hashtag, and I look forward to our next presentation. Thank you very much.